staring into the abyss, so you don't have to. This is hell, and the abyss we are staring into is the apparently bottomless pit of U.S. denialism about the genocide in Gaza. If you thought that was bad under Biden and Harris, wait until you hear what Trump and Vance and the Heritage Foundation have cooked up for the region. Basically, it's more of the same, but instead of denying the U.S. role in war crimes and atrocities, the incoming administration will brag about their deadly cruelty. Also, college campuses are getting even creepier as protests against the genocide in Gaza have returned. Here to help guide us through all of this, we are very happy to have on the show Israeli-American writer, photographer, and neuroscientist Yoav Litvin, who recently wrote the Al Jazeera article, Project Esther, a Trumpian blueprint to crush anti-colonial resistance. Welcome to This Is Hell, Yoav.
Hi there. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much for being on the show, and thank you for your patience with us and the blizzard today and unfortunate illness yesterday. But we do have some breaking news. I wanted to get your, and it's not just the blizzard, I wanted to get your impressions on this. CNN is reporting that the International Criminal Court has issued arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, and a Hamas official who they accuse of war crimes, who they also claim they had killed in September, but Hamas has not confirmed that the person who Israel believes is behind the October 7th attacks earlier this year, but there is no confirmation of his death, so there's also an arrest warrant for him. What impact, right, if any, do you think this will have on the situation in Gaza? And most importantly, the question that people always seem to forget to ask, what impact do you think this will have on the people who are still alive in Gaza?
Yeah, well, I think all of us who have been against this ongoing genocide have a additional skip in our step, or, you know, finally, something is moving within the international court system that we can point to as indicative of progress, anti-genocide movement. So as far as that's concerned, this is a pleasant surprise to wake up to. Many people didn't believe that this would happen in these last months of our lame duck president. So this is a great development. As far as actual practical effects on the ongoing genocide, it's very hard to tell. I'm very doubtful as far as any real developments. Of course, we all know that the United States is what counts in the international court, in the international system, unfortunately. So we will see how. I know that they canceled the press briefing today. So they're probably reeling and trying to figure out how they're going to respond to this. I'm sure that people in Gaza are not under the illusion that this is suddenly going to change everything. But I do hope that it at least, you know, creates some kind of positive vibe for them. And perhaps this is the beginning of something greater. Who knows? But I'm, like I said, I'm doubtful and waiting to see. Doubtful and hopeful at the same time.
That's the one thing I think it does give. At least it gives the smallest measure of hope, and hope is in very short supply nowadays. You begin by writing, Donald Trump's re-election as president of the United States marks a shift in U.S. policy from the Joe Biden administration's hypocritical denial of American complicity in Zionist genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity, to an unapologetic endorsement of all these actions. So in your framing, our choices in the election were denial of complicity in genocide or endorsing that complicity to genocide, but pretending it's not happening while continuing to send arms used in that genocide in Israel, or admitting it's happening while continuing to send arms used in the genocide by Israel. What does that tell you about the current debate over foreign policy in the U.S. when our choice is denying we're contributing to genocide or admitting to it?
You know, I often say that the U.S. Mirrors the progress or lack of progress, the regression that goes on within the Israeli political system, within the apartheid state. So this is a process that happened probably a decade ago, more even, in Israel, where the liberal system collapsed, and liberal Zionism, even though it manages to revive itself every so often with the fallacy of the two-state solution and so-called peace negotiations, we really see its complete dissolution and utter decay in the last, you know, year plus since October 7th. And we see that here in the U.S. I mean, the administration has been utterly pathetic as far as its response to this genocide, as far as funding it. I mean, it's the engine behind the genocide, and the denialism has pushed people to, you know, look at this administration and say, hey, these guys are hypocrites. Here's Donald Trump. At least he's, you know, straight up with us. At least he's fascist 100% and not 99.9%. So, you know, we see the what's called a global neoliberal order completely kind of crumbling in front of us. And it's hard to say that this is a, you know, a positive necessarily development, but there are positive aspects where maybe finally we will see justice, because these propaganda systems are upholding these policies. Without them, then the liberals who, you know, have significant capital and influence would not be able to save face, right? So the same thing is happening here in the U.S. Joe Biden has been an utter catastrophe, potentially the worst president in U.S. history. And, you know, people are tired of it. And we see the rise of a WrestleMania icon, Donald Trump. Again, you know, it's pretty unbelievable to see this, but this is kind of textbook corruption of the liberal order leads to fascism. So that's what we're facing.
So what role, I was going to ask you, what role did the U.S. play in the collapse of liberal Zionism? But I think a bigger question here is, why do you think those who are embrace liberalism, why do you think that they didn't recognize the threat that neoliberalism would be to liberalism?
You know, white privilege is a dangerous drug and a hell of a drug, right? And people, this system promotes white privilege and adjacent to white privilege, all those who kind of, you know, kiss the ring of the white master. And it's a very complex system that provides rewards for those. And you know, I could say that I am guilty of this as well. Most of us, at least white people, are guilty of this. Even if we don't necessarily admit to it. So the process of decolonization is ongoing. And I think that liberals, the MSNBC type, have a long way to go. Let's put it that way.
So to what extent do you see U.S. policy toward Israel and Palestinians as being bipartisan? Is the only difference denial of or open complicity to genocide?
Zionism, you know, has been dependent on imperialism from day one. It was the UK initially, and it's become the US, most notably after the Six-Day War in 1967. So there's nothing new. The Israel is a vassal state that promotes American interests in the Middle East and the world. It's a huge market for the United States. So, like I said, the only thing that's changed is the obviousness of it, if you'd like. We can see it so clearly now because it's not this periodic mowing the lawn, so-called mowing the lawn, which is, you know, Israeli bombing of Gaza, 1,000 or so Palestinian civilians murdered, and then back to quote unquote the status quo of kind of implicit ongoing dispossession and genocide. This is a year-long genocide of the most brutal type that we've ever witnessed. Live stream on TikTok, and I don't use TikTok, but Twitter, whatever you use. Only the American mainstream media have not been showing the scenes that we've been seeing, and just utterly horrified. So it's just a level. The level has gone up. It's not like anything is really new. This is an imperialist project that's been carrying out genocide since before 1948. And it's finally been exposed. So hopefully, I'm very cautious as far as my optimism, because things can always get worse and people can regress very easily into that white privilege if they're threatened. So hopefully this will lead to some kind of awakening and a progressive process that will lead to the fall of apartheid. But, you know, with Donald Trump at the helm, there's going to be every motivation from the United States to stop this process.
What do you think it reveals about liberalism when it seems like to me, and, you know, this could just be a misperception on my part, but it seems like to me that so many liberals, so many of the, as you were saying, the MSNBC types, are incredibly upset about the incoming Trump administration, far more than they were about genocide for 13 months. What does that reveal about right. liberalism in the United States when it seems like liberals are more upset about Donald Trump being president than an ongoing genocide?
Yeah, the ongoing genocide, they don't care. It's brown people who are being slaughtered. Like I said, this goes back to white supremacy and white privilege. They don't like that people associate them when they go on their business trips or wherever around the world. They don't like that people associate them with this clown that's coming into office. And they don't like their rights being impinged on. A lot of them actually prefer Trump as far as policy, tax breaks, etc. But, you know, the clownish behavior and his past being a sexual predator and all of his corruption is very embarrassing to them. So this is something that they can rally around this personality. And I think actually it serves Republican interest to have this kind of clown at the top where people can focus their ire on him rather than actually what he's promoting, rather than on the governors and on the judges and all the people who he's placing to govern us. He's a convenient target. He's very good at media manipulation, very similar to Netanyahu. And this is kind of an ongoing circus where they can pretend that they're in the quote unquote resistance by resisting Donald Trump, but not resisting the policy. And the policy is genocide. That is the policy of American imperialism. It is just now so explicit, so in your face, that people think, oh my God, this is something new. It is definitely not new. I mean, the scale of it is new, but the policy itself is just the same old business for Uncle Sam.
You write that Trump says Biden has been weak in countering, quote, Hamas radicals, and he would do even more to shut down anti-colonial resistance as president. So this might reveal something about our democracy or whatever democracy we have here in the United States. Yoav, can we vote for anti-colonialism or anti-imperialism in the United States?
I mean, we had other choices this election, and those choices were more attractive if you vote with your ideals. However, as we know, within this two-party system, only corporations are really on the ballot. Which corporations? Are there the Republican corporations or the Democratic corporations? So can we vote our way out of this? I think it's pretty clear that we cannot. I think we have to focus on local activism, on local representatives, and when the time comes every 4 years to make a choice, sure, that's important to do. Even though I have to say that, you know, this time around when people told me that they're not voting, I couldn't bring myself to, excuse me, to judge them or to tell them, hey, you know, people fought for your rights to vote, et cetera, because I thought that was a legitimate choice within the choices we had. I didn't necessarily endorse it, but in this corrupt system and in this election cycle, which was such a joke from both corporate parties, it was a very depressing choice to me.
Exit polls and vote counts indicate that there was Muslim opposition to a Harris presidency, especially in places like Detroit, where Democratic Representative Rashid Tlaib won re-election easily, while Trump took both Dearborn and Dearborn Heights, where she represents the people of those cities. In fact, Dearborn council member Mustafa Hammond told the Associated Press all she had to do, Harris, all Kamala Harris had to do was stop the war in Lebanon and Gaza, and she would receive everyone's votes here. Do you believe Harris or the Democratic Party chose continued support for Israel and Gaza over keeping the White House?
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely. I think there's no doubt about it. And I go even a step further as far as what she had to do. I think if she had just platformed a Palestinian person at the DNC, just that tiny, tiny, quote unquote, concession, I think that would have given her many more votes. Just the recognition of Palestinian humanity, even though, you know, while an ongoing genocide, I would argue that's not a real recognition of humanity. However, people like symbolic gestures. She couldn't even bring herself to do that. So how can anybody expect people who have relatives in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Lebanon, in Yemen, in Iran, in Syria, to go out and vote for a person who is literally bombing their relatives? It's just unfathomable that that the Democratic Party were just on a kamikaze kind of a campaign trail.
A letter to the incoming Trump administration from Muslim leaders, MENA, Middle East, North Africa, American Chamber of Commerce in Dearborn, Michigan, reads, "We are urging your administration," telling this to the Trump administration again, "we are urging your administration and transition team to apply your political influence in demanding an immediate ceasefire in Lebanon and Palestine. This aligns to the commitment toward lasting peace which you made. We urge you to call for an immediate ceasefire in Lebanon and Palestine while crafting a long-lasting peace in the region. Further, we believe your team's leadership will be instrumental in advancing productive U.S.-Lebanese relations." They add that Dearborn, Michigan, a city with the highest concentration of Arab Americans outside the Middle East, turned red in this presidential election due to Trump's, your genuine outreach to our community and our belief that you are the optimal choice for our democracy, economy, and matters of foreign policy. The over 3.5 million MENA Americans, some of whom reside in the swing states, are proud to have contributed to your margins of victory, particularly in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Georgia. Your success is a testament to your resonance with the values and concerns of Middle East, North African Americans. Did Trump, in your opinion, make a commitment to peace that Harris did not? Whether he will go through with it or not, did he make a commitment? And do you believe if Harris had, she would have won?
I'm a behaviorist. I don't believe in politicians. So that's my go-to. I just disregard what they say, and then I look at their behavior. And if you look at Harris or Trump, look at their behavior. You look at Trump ever since he got elected, his appointments, for example, do not indicate any chance of him fulfilling whatever he, you know, regurgitated during the campaign trail in order to get people to vote for him. So while I completely understand and empathize with people in Dearborn, Michigan for writing that, and even for voting Trump, I won't judge them, because nobody can judge people who are going, you know, undergoing genocide. And I won't, especially while the genocide is still ongoing, I will not berate or talk down to anybody like that. But I will say that I believe that their hopes will not be, will not materialize. Trump, if you look at his behavior, is a classic right-wing ideologue and demagogue. He uses whatever he needs to use in order to get in office, and then forget about it. Forget about it. He will do what makes him look powerful, what promotes his agenda. That's what we have to look forward to. So, you know, behind the scenes, Trump does want to look like a deal maker. And that's a potential, and he doesn't like to be humiliated. So these two things can work to the advantage of Palestinian people and others who are under the boot of white supremacy. You know, if you can present a deal that would make Trump look good with Iran or anybody else, then there is some hope. But relying on his rhetoric is, I think just hopelessly optimistic.
You mentioned his nominees so far, and you write that Trump named Kristi Noem, the South Dakota governor who once introduced a bill cracking down on criticism of Israel on the grounds of ensuring the security of God's chosen people, as his Secretary of Homeland Security. So as someone who is Israeli-American, how do you feel, and Jewish, how do you feel when far-right politicians like Kristi Noem, who is Christian, says she wants to ensure the security of God's chosen people? Because that almost sounds like when Trump said he will protect women if they want it or not. How do you feel when somebody like Kristi Noem says she wants to ensure the security of God's chosen people?
Right. It's an expression of how Zionism manipulates and co-opts Judaism to promote an imperialist white supremacist agenda, which is something I write a lot about. And it goes back to Project Esther, which is written by the Heritage Foundation. It's not a Jewish organization. It's a Christian organization, or at least grounded in Christian nationalism, right wing, that is using all of Zionism's talking points to promote white supremacy abroad and to stifle dissent here at home. So Zionism has become a very useful tool for the right wing here in the United States. And Kristi Noem, Mike Huckabee, Donald Trump, all these characters who are not Jewish, using Judaism, using anti-Semitism. They are the biggest anti-Semites. Zionism is a very anti-Semitic movement. So we are in a position where anti-Zionist Jews and organizations are being actively targeted under the guise of anti-Semitism. It's a ludicrous situation that is extremely dangerous as well. So it makes me very angry to when people like Kristi Noem, who is a xenophobe and anti-indigenous governor, when she talks about the chosen people and all these kind of Zionist tropes, it's extremely aggravating for me, to be honest.
So people who might be accidentally tuning into our radio stations around the North America today, how do you see Zionism as being an act of anti-Semitism?
Oh, in multiple ways. First of all, you look at the history. Okay, so if you go back to the history, you see that Zionists have collaborated with anti-Semites from the beginning of the movement. Zionists subscribe to the notion of global apartheid, where the black people should be here, the white people should be here, and the Jewish people should be here. That is an anti-Semitic notion, where Jews are not welcome in nations around the world. So that is huge. Second of all, Zionism scapegoats I would prefer if it were more people, but a lot of people who are Jewish and anti-Zionists, right? So it scapegoats these people and it targets these people that is anti-Semitic, like I said, in Project Esther. And the function itself of Zionism as an apartheid genocidal movement, claiming that it acts as a leader and leading the Jewish people, in itself is an anti-Semitic action, because then Jewish people are associated with this apartheid genocidal entity And Jews all around the world are scapegoated because of that, even if they have nothing to do with Israel, have never been to Israel, and they're just practicing Jews who want to live at peace. So Zionism on multiple levels is anti-Semitic.
So you were saying that the Heritage Foundation is exploiting anti-Semitism, exploiting Judaism. And if so, what happens when something as serious and real as anti-Semitism is exploited for these far-right reactionary political ends?
Well, first of all, they'll say, oh my God, look, there's a rise in anti-Semitism and it's grounded in this anti-Zionist, anti-capitalist, Palestinian agenda. So the first thing that they'll do is associate it with anti-colonialism. Then they'll say, this is a sign. Well, it depends where, right? If this is in the U.S. or in Europe, this is very attractive for Israel. They want white Jewish people to come. So they'll say, oh, you see, we told you, this is a sign that you have to come to Israel and live with your fellow Jewish people and settle here with us. And this is, of course, a means of combating the Palestinian quote-unquote demographic threat, right? And manning the military. You get more people. So the framing of it immediately places it within, erroneously and very fascistically, places it within a completely opposite position where, and that's why they say that every Zionist accusation is a confession, right? When Zionists, and you see that in Project Esther very well, when they claim that Haman, the vizier Haman, who was supposedly the embodiment of anti-Semitism in this myth, they claim that the anti-colonial activists are representative of Haman. And in the same document, they target Jewish organizations, showing that they are actually the ones who are anti-Semitic. So in every Zionist accusation, you have to look for a confession. And this is no different. We see this time and time again. It's really kind of mind-boggling. If you are woke to this methodology, it just repeats itself over and over again. And it's for audiences within Israel especially, but also for liberal audiences and right-wing audiences all around the world.
That's absolutely brilliant, and that's why I wanted you to be on our show so much. We are speaking with Israeli-American writer, photographer, and neuroscientist Yoav Litvin, who recently wrote the Al Jazeera article, Project Esther, a Trumpian blueprint to crush anti-colonial resistance. He is a board member of the Whatcom Peace and Justice Center. You can find out more about that group at Whatcom, WhatcomPJC.org, and on X at the same thing, WhatcomPJC. And you can find out more about Yoav at his website, YoavLitvin.com, and on X at a really great handle for a neuroscientist. Nuclear, N-O-O-K-Y-E-L-U-R. If you're enjoying our conversation with Yoav, please show your support for Completely Listener Supported This Is Hell by subscribing to our Patreon at patreon.com/thisishell. So you write that created by the same minds that brought us the Authoritarian Christian Nationalist Project 2025, Project Esther syncretizes the story of Queen Esther, the Jewish heroine celebrated during Purim, for saving Jews of ancient Persia from extermination at the hands of, who you're saying, Vizier Haman, with modern-day Zionist narratives of defense and victimhood to depict her as a defender of Jews against activists, academics, and progressive members of Congress in the U.S. who oppose racism, apartheid, and genocide. The goal here is to make the story of Esther coexist in harmony with the idea of Zionism. Esther, however, lived in the 5th century BCE, and Zionism was coined by Nathan Birnbaum, a Jewish nationalist, in 1890. How does Zionism change the story of Esther, and is the story of Esther a story that, in its original reading, promotes Zionism, a Jewish nation state?
Well, let me just add that Zionism was, as a modern movement, was formed way before the 19th century during the Protestant Reformation. So it is initially and fundamentally a Manifest Destiny Christian movement that was later taken up by Jewish people And that is very important to understand as far as the structure of Zionism, which is a white supremacist movement, and it uses Judaism as a tool. That's first and foremost. And it's very important to understand that also when we look at Project Esther, which is a manifestation of the kind of coming home, the chickens coming home to roost of Zionism to its benefactor here in the United States. And it's coming home to roost because it's nakedly showing us how it is an anti-Jewish movement that seeks to promote anti-Semitism and global apartheid. It targets the people who are most resistant to this kind of framing, to Palestinian people, of course, and also all of their allies, all of their anti-colonial allies in the world, right? We see that Project Esther is focused on promoting the Trumpian, the Republican, the imperialist goals and targets of global hegemony, of fossil fuel extraction, of you know, just a disaster that we're facing with climate change. It all comes to the center stage with Zionism serving as a tool to both promote these agendas abroad and stifle dissent here at home.
You point out that Project Esther shamelessly states its aims to eliminate anti-colonial perspectives from the U.S. education system, limit the dissemination of related information, and restrict advocates' access to American society, the economy, and Congress. Is the goal of Project Esther to teach support for Zionism to children in public schools here in the States and elsewhere? Is the goal to make students in the U.S. not only believe in the myth of American exceptionalism and innocence, but to do the same with Israel too? Do they want students to be taught to be patriots, not only of the United States, but Israel as well?
I mean, I think that's already the case in many, 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 many schools, evangelical schools, which are Zionist, fundamentally Zionist schools. So millions of people, there are more Christian Zionists in the United States than there are Jewish Zionists in Israel. So as far as inserting this into the education system, the only thing that is missing is the actual formality of it. And this goes back to Trump putting in charge all these just completely inadequate people in charge of different departments of state, including education. And yes, this will potentially be part of the educational, formally part of the educational system. There is a merging of the United States and Israel. It's like before Israel at least pretended to be independent. Now it's just a vassal state that carries out American interests and is pretty much, we can see this in the United Nations Security Council. We can see this today's International Criminal Court decision. Israel cannot stand without the United States. So rather than abandon it, the United States has given Israel a huge bear hug, potentially at the expense of its own interests. I mean, not even potentially. I'd say its interests, if we're talking about the people, it's important to divide those two, right? We're not talking about the weapons manufacturers, Wall Street, etc. It is definitely against the people's interests, but pro-capital interests. So, yes, we are seeing Zionism become very mainstream in this bear hug. And it's not just coming from the United States. I mean, we see far-right leaders all across the world. I mean, Geert Wilders, the Dutch strongman, embraced this notion of these football hooligans, the Zionist Israeli Maccabi Tel Aviv football hooligans who came and tore down Palestinian flags and beat up taxi drivers. He embraced the notion that this was a huge anti-Semitic riot, you know, again, proving that Zionism is a tool for these far-right actors here in the United States and all over the world. And all of these far-right actors, they're promoting white Western supremacy with capitalism serving as the engine of this machine.
So does Zionism turn Judaism into this kind of ass-kicking Jesus Christ that today's Christian nationalists often depict? And is there a similarity between the two understandings coming from a similar place of religious beliefs?
Well, Zionism created this notion of what's called a new Jew. Jews back in the, especially in the 19th century, were facing very harsh conditions. They couldn't own land outside certain areas. And after the assassination of Tsar Alexander II, they were blamed for it. But it was a revolutionary group called Narodnaya Volya, actually, who assassinated him. But they were blamed for it, and there were huge pogroms. And on this medium, on this setting, Zionism was very appealing because the Jews, a lot of them were looking for identity, were looking for a way to create an identity within a milieu of colonialism, which was huge back then, and rising fascism. And Zionism appealed to this by presenting this idea of a homeland, right? So remind me the question again. Sorry, I got off on a tangent.
I got a better question. So is support for Zionism in Gaza is, because here in the United States, people are, you know this, people are talking about, you know, why has white supremacy been on the surge for at least the last 10 years, if not the last 250, but is support for Zionism, is that what is leading or at least contributing to more white supremacy in the United States? And if so, why?
Well, absolutely. First of all, I mean, white supremacy has always been the engine of this settler colony. The eradication of the indigenous people was very, very, very much a mirror of Zionist. I mean, Zionism has used American settler colonialism as a model, as did the Nazis. So this is a movement that, you know, settler colonies throughout the world, Australia, New Zealand, many places in the Americas, etc. This is a movement that came out of Europe and believes in this idea of the white civilized people banishing the heathen hordes and brown skin hordes. And Christianity was used in the Americas, just like Judaism is now used in the Middle East. So this is a model of oppression. This is a model of capitalist resource extraction. And this actually brings me back to the point that I was going to make before. These Jewish people took up self-defense, took up arms in self-defense, because this whole notion of a new Jew was about shedding these, what they considered old-fashioned ideas of Judaism, where you accepted whatever fate you received because it's God's will. And you actually took up arms. And Zionists, all they did was they transitioned, and we see this until today, self-defense being used as a means of conquering, genociding, annexing, right? They took self-defense and they kind of transformed it into offensive aggression. And it's something that I talk about a lot, which is against the UN Charter. If you claim self-defense, that you're allowed to defend yourself according to the UN Charter. Plus, internally, within the Zionist population, it's much easier to digest genocidal policies when you are scared, when you are traumatized, and when you think that you are acting in self-defense. So the whole system behaviorally is very fascinating to me, and that's kind of my niche, my angle. To disassemble the propaganda by using a behavioral analysis that sheds all the rhetoric, all the lies, and just focuses on what these states, entities, politicians, what are they actually doing in practice?
And avoid the distraction of just looking at Donald Trump as a person instead of what not only what they stand for, but the actual policies that he brings into action. You also had an article that was posted in October at Al Jazeera with the headline, "Zionist safety patrols on campus have little concern for Jewish safety. Self-defense has vastly different meanings for the colonized and the colonizer." As somebody who is Jewish, they say that these safety patrols are to protect you from anti-Semitism. Have you seen a vast increase in anti-Semitism? Have you felt far less secure on campus or anywhere? And do you think that these Zionist safety patrols are necessary because of those kinds of threats?
No, of course not. I mean, the pro-Palestinian anti-genocide students and supporters are the most disciplined anti-racist, anti-Semitism people in the United States that I've ever met. And I've not seen a single case of real anti-Semitism. And now we go back to the vote that happened a couple of days ago, where they changed the definition of anti-Semitism. Again, you have to look at what they're actually doing in policy. They changed the definition of anti-Semitism to conform with anti-Israel, anti-Zionist behavior. So now they can claim, hey, look, there's a spike in anti-Semitism, whereas what we're seeing is people saying, don't murder my family, please. So, and that is scapegoated as anti-Semitism. And then they bring in these vigilante groups and they say, oh, we're self-defense groups. Where in fact, they are absolutely not self-defense groups. They are offensive groups that are acting exactly the way that Zionist forces act in Palestine. They oppress, they use any means necessary to scapegoat, they lie, they frame people for doing things, and it's a very dangerous situation. So we have to be extremely vigilant of both the physical threat and also the legal threat that people face, because a lot of people can be jailed and worse for years.
And you write at the University of Toronto, Megan Harut, Canada, Defender of Freedom Canada, a volunteer-based Zionist vigilante group affiliated with Harut Canada, an organization tied to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's far-right revisionist Likud Party, which advocates for the greater Israel settler colonial vision, was mobilized to ostensibly defend Jewish students from what they claim to be protesters' anti-Semitism. So you also point out that Megan Harut plans to expand its volunteer safety patrols across the United Canada and into the United States. Do you know if that has happened yet? Have there been more reports of Zionist intimidation and vigilante groups here in the United States yet?
I have read some reports. I've read a report of one organization. I think it's called, it also references the Purim, the myth of Esther, as a means of galvanizing Jews against so-called anti-Semitism. And I saw they're doing some retreat where you learn, you know, how to use a gun pretty much and again, defend yourself against anti-Semitism. So yes, this is definitely something that is spreading. There is, and these groups, you know, they have the same interests as the rising neo-Nazi groups. And we see it. Again, you asked me before, why do I see Zionism as anti-Semitism? It's enough to look at who their friends are. You know, they say know somebody by their friends. The people who are their friends and who they collaborate with and have always collaborated with, you know, Balfour was a known anti-Semite. Are these neo-Nazi groups, and therefore we can see that anti-colonial resistance that is intersectional, anti-colonial resistance that is comprised of Black, Brown, Indigenous, immigrant communities, they're all tied to the Palestinian cause. So this is really a focal point and a nexus of where we should be, really vigilant about. And the struggle for justice in Palestine has ramifications for all of us.
You write that Megan Harut works closely with JForce, a private security firm that provides protest security for Israel supporters. JForce deploys volunteers to pro-Palestine events in tactical gear. Both groups are expected to remain active on campus throughout the academic year. And Southern Poverty Law Center has designated the Jewish Defense League as a hate group. You write that Zionist activists with the Jewish Defense League have also been spotted at pro-Palestinian events at the university at Toronto. The group, which was largely inactive prior to October 7th, was deemed a right-wing terrorist group by the U.S. FBI in 2001. What does it tell you about university policy when it allows a designated hate group, a designated terrorist group on campus, but not peaceful protesters?
Right. It's beholden to its capital interests, right? It's the board members who and its contributors who bring in the money. This is what happens when you privatize education. You get educators who are beholden to these interests and interest groups. Again, something that Trump is promoting. So it's very clear to me how why universities are a focal point where young people are being educated and all the, you know, injustice that's going on. And there are people from all over the world. And these right-wing groups are going after not only these people, but also the policies that have enabled many disenfranchised people to study, right? Trump is going after all these policies that are enabling this. So there's a multi-level effort to delegitimize this struggle. And, you know, with the way things going, it's hard to find hope. Quite honestly, for me, I do find hope, for example, today in the ICC's decision. But it's very, I think we're in a kind of quiet before the storm stage. And these 2 months where we have a lame duck president are extremely dangerous. That said, let me just say one more thing. It is very important to pressure universities, to abide by the boycott, divestment, and sanctions call for divestment from entities that are directly and indirectly related to ongoing apartheid and genocide in Palestine. So here in Washington State, there have been numerous victories, and other places around the country, there have been numerous victories, and I think the pressure needs to escalate.
How sustainable do you think this conflation of Zionism with Judaism is? Because they're not the same thing. How sustainable is this idea that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism?
Well, I struggle with this every day in discussions with people and on social media. People are very much wedded, including Palestinian people who've been told their whole lives by Zionists that it's Jews who are victimizing them. So it's very hard to judge Palestinian people who see Jewish people as the people oppressing them, because they've been told time and again this propaganda that Zionism is Judaism. However, other than Palestinians who undergo this direct oppression, we see this picked up by neo-Nazis like David Duke, for example, who uses the very dangerous terminology that I write a lot about called to describe Zionism as Jewish supremacy. And this is a kind of a perfect gift to Zionist propaganda, because there is nothing Jewish about Zionism, quite the contrary. And any admission that Zionism is Judaism is a loss, immediate loss. So what do? We have to keep insisting that Zionism is not Judaism. And this is not in order to claim that Jews are not at fault or to get out of some kind of blame, etc. This is to focus on who is really in charge here and what forces are actually driving this violence. It's extremely important.
You write, the Jewish community's long history of trauma and persecution should inspire a unified pursuit of justice, freedom, and equality for everyone, rejecting Zionist vigilante terrorism. Whether it's Arlie Russell Hochschild, who we've recently spoken to, the renowned sociologist, or whether it's the world's leading authority on famine, Alex DeWall, who was on earlier this week, they point out that, as you were saying with white supremacy, shame is also a very powerful drug, and it often leads to violence. To you, what explains why the trauma and persecution that have been experienced over this long history to the Jewish community, what explains that leading to vigilante terrorism and not a unified pursuit of justice?
Right. Well, this is exactly the transformation from defense to offense that I was referring to. You take a population that's been traumatized, that's been really destroyed by violence. And I'm talking before the Nazi Holocaust. I'm talking about these pogroms that were devastating in Imperial Russia and other places. And you take a population that's traumatized, and you try and reconstruct their identity, and that is a huge success for Zionist propaganda. And just to remind the listeners, Zionism was extremely unpopular among the Jewish population initially. It was a very fringe group, just like what we saw the Tea Party as a kind of kooks, you know, and very extremist people who, okay, fine, we're a democracy, there are these extremists, okay, that's fine, we'll tolerate them, which is fine. However, the Zionism was given a gift by Adolf Hitler. And that gift was, you know, it's you know, hard to say that a Holocaust is a gift, but without the Nazi Holocaust, Zionism would not have succeeded, because first of all, it provided the people who came. Zionism was at a huge crisis and did not have enough people in Palestine. Suddenly, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of refugees were arriving at its shores. And secondly, it galvanized international support, especially from Europe, people were looking for a way to redeem themselves, to pass off their guilt. And the way they did it, we see today in Germany, we still see it so, you know, so obviously how they're trying to make up for their awful sin of the Holocaust by supporting this apartheid entity. So it's very clear, and you see it also in Israel itself, how the trauma of October 7th, going back to how trauma is used, is just regurgitated again and again. I dare you to open Israeli TV for one day and not see half of the airtime devoted to families of the abductees, of the victims of October 7th. It has to be constantly reinforced, this fear, in order to be able to sustain this level of genocidal violence.
And as your expertise is in the neuroscience of emotion, that, as you know, that fear can have a huge impact on your ability for good decision making. We've been speaking with Israeli American writer, photographer, neuroscientist Yoav Litvin. Recently wrote the Al Jazeera article Project Esther, a Trumpian blueprint to crush anti-colonial resistance. Find out more about Yoav at yoavlitvin.com and on X at Nuclear, that's spelled Nooky Lur. We end each one of our interviews, Yoav, with what we call the question from hell. The question we may hate to ask, you may hate to answer. And I think this one's going to fall in the final category, and that is, our audience may hate your response. You write, the Zionist white supremacist partnership poses a direct challenge to justice movements and humanity as a whole, using fear, propaganda, and violence to undermine efforts for genuine solidarity and liberation. So, Yoav, my question from hell for you is, how does this threaten humanity as a whole? And I know that the answer is going to be hellish.
Well, we see the forces that are backing Zionism. These forces are the same forces that have created the just catastrophic climate crisis that we're all facing. These are the forces of capital that are continuing to drill, baby drill, right? And are ignoring science, scapegoating scientists, scapegoating academics, killing and murdering journalists, doctors, torturing, raping, you know, what have you. These are the exact same forces. And if today I had to point to one threat that we should all face, is this threat. This is the threat that we face as human beings. There is either Zionism backed by U.S. imperialism or humanity. This is the choice.
Yoav, I've really enjoyed our conversation this morning, despite the tenor of it. But I've really enjoyed our conversation. We'd love to have you back on the show. Thanks for your patience with us this week. I truly appreciate it. And we really look forward to having you back on the show. If you ever want to come back on this show, please get in contact with us. We'd love to have you back on.
Thanks so much, Chuck. And I really appreciate the fact that you understood the humor behind my Twitter handle.
Yes, I liked it. Yeah, which is crazy because we've had this other guest on. This is how dumb I am, Yoav. Her name is Jennifer Berkshire. Her Twitter handle is B is for Berkshire. That makes sense. For 5 years, I've been saying it's Biz for Berkshire because I couldn't figure out that it was B is for Berkshire.
So right.
I could figure out nuclear.
Yeah, it was my little, as a scientist, every time somebody says nuclear and not nuclear, I cringe. So I was like, okay, I gotta use that.
I love when people say, oh, it's similar to nuclear.
Right. Exactly.
All right, take care, Yoav. We'll be speaking to you soon. Right. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Take care. Live from land stolen from the Anishinaabe, including the Potawatomi, Ottawa, and Ojibwe, and the Illinois Confederation consisting of